The time had come for the curtain to go up on the third act of our tragedy. Time also for Hercule Poirot to return to the stage. I called on Mr. Satterthwaite in London, but was told he was away in Lumoth, and so I caught the first train and presented myself at Crow's Nest, where I found Sir Charles and Mr. Satterthwaite and Miss Lytton Gore seated together at the scene of the crime.
My dear fellow, what a pleasant surprise. Come on through, join us by the fire.
Dragging yourself all the way down here on such a stormy night.
But why are you here, Monsieur Poirot? I mean, have you come for any particular reason?
I have come to admit an error.
Hmm?
Sir Charles.
Yes?
It was in this very room that you declared you were not satisfied that Mr. Babington had died a natural death.
Uh-huh.
And I thought it was simply your instinct for drama. It seemed to me incredible that such a harmless old gentleman should have been murdered. Even now, I cannot guess at any motive. But since there has been another death under similar circumstances, which I cannot attribute to coincidence, there must be a link between the two. And so, I have come to apologize. I was wrong, and I request you to admit me to your counsels.
Oh, well, this is extraordinarily handsome of you, Monsieur Poirot, giving up your time like this.
Well, it's certainly very good of you.
No, my friend, it is not good of me. It is curiosity. And I must admit, the hurt to my pride. But of course, if I am not welcome, if you feel that I am intruding...
No, well, of course not, Monsieur Poirot.
Oh, indeed, no.
And Mademoiselle...
I'm sure we'd love to have you, Monsieur Poirot.
Good. We are colleagues. And now, if you please, put me au courant of the situation.
We would be very pleased to do so, and we would welcome your expertise. But so far, we've made very little positive progress at all, except for one significant discovery. But let me take you through the course of our investigation.
Mais c'est magnifique. The discovery of the letters written by the butler puts an entirely new aspect on the case. I congratulate you both, gentlemen.
So now you know everything we know. How does it all strike you?
Can you remember, mademoiselle, what type of port glass Sir Bartholomew had on his table?
No, I didn't really notice them at all.
I can tell you. They were like these glasses of mine. These are sherry glasses, of course. His were the proper port shape. He got a set of table glasses at a sale, and as there were more than he needed, he gave some of them to me. Rather good, aren't they?
Yes, they are fine specimens. I rather thought something of the kind had been used.
Why?
The death of Sir Bartholomew Strange could be explained easily enough, but the death of the Reverend Stephen Babington is more difficult. If only it had been the other way about.
What on earth do you mean by that?
Oh, consider, mademoiselle. Sir Bartholomew is a celebrated doctor. A doctor knows secrets. Important secrets. A doctor may have suspicions about the sudden death of one of his patients. Oh, yes. We can find plenty of motives for the death of a doctor.
But why the other way about?
If Sir Bartholomew had died first, it is possible that Stephen Babington might have seen something, might have suspected something.
Unfortunately, the deaths didn't happen in that order.
Alas, one must take a case as it is. Just one little idea I would like to suggest. I suppose it is not possible that Stephen Babington's death was an accident, that the poison was intended for Sir Bartholomew, and the glass was picked up by the wrong man?
Oh, it's an ingenious idea, Monsieur Poirot, but you see, nobody who knew Tolly would have tried poisoning him with a cocktail.
Why not?
Because he had a particular aversion to them.
Oh, it's business. It goes all wrong. It does not make sense.
Besides, I don't see how any one glass could have been mistaken for another. Temple carried them round on a tray, and everyone helped themselves to any glass they fancied.
True. One cannot force a cocktail as one forces a card.
It's instinctive to take the one next to you.
Mm. Tell me, Mr. Satterthwaite, did Mr. Babington put his cocktail down, or did he retain it in his hand?
He put it down on the table.
And did anyone come near the glass after he had done so?
No. I was nearest to him, and I assure you I didn't tamper with it in any way, even if I could have done so unobserved.
No, my friend, I am not making an accusation, but I want to be sure of my facts. According to the analysis, there was nothing out of the way in that cocktail. But Mr. Babington ate and drank nothing else. You see where that leads us?
Nowhere, damn it.
No, I would not say that. It suggests a very monstrous idea, which I hope and trust cannot be true.
What are you going on about?
No, Mrs. Babington was not at Melford Abbey, therefore Mrs. Babington is cleared of suspicion.
But no one has ever dreamed of suspecting her.
No. But if the poor gentleman was not poisoned by a cocktail, then he must have been poisoned a few minutes before entering the house. Perhaps by a tablet to prevent indigestion. And who then could have tampered with that?
But they were devoted to each other. Oh, you don't understand a bit.
Now, let me tell you something, mademoiselle. In the course of my experience, I have known 5 cases of wives murdered by devoted husbands, and 25 of husbands murdered by devoted wives. Les femmes, they obviously keep up appearances better.
I think you're perfectly horrid. The Babingtons were not like that. It's monstrous.
Murder is monstrous, mademoiselle. But I, who see only the facts, agree that Mrs. Babington did not do this thing. The killer could only have been one of the people who were present on both occasions, one of the 7 on your list.
So how do you advise us to act?
You have doubtless agreed on a plan?
Well, the only way forward seems to be a process of elimination. My idea was to take each name on that list and consider them guilty until they're proved innocent. Mm-hmm. If we suspect there is a connection between that person and Stephen Babington, we use all our ingenuity to find out what that connection may be. If we find no connection, we move on to the next name on the list.
It is good psychology, that. And what are your methods?
We've not yet had time to discuss that, but perhaps you yourself?
No. Do not ask me to do anything of an active nature. It is my lifelong conviction that problems are best solved by thought, by the application of the little grey cells. Let me hold what is called, I believe, a watching brief. You will perhaps from time to time wish to turn to me for counsel's opinion. Does that make sense to you, mademoiselle?
Excellent sense. I'm sure your experience will be very useful to us. But I must be off. Mother will have a fit.
Oh, you'll get soaked to the skin. I'll drive you back.
That would be very kind. Good night, Mr. Satterthwaite.
Good night.
Good night,
Poirot.
Good night.
Good night.
So, you see, Mr. Satterthwaite, the fish is risen. You have achieved what you wished on that morning in Monte Carlo. You knew that, like the little child who was playing close by us, I was bored. I had nothing to do. And now I must admit that I find this strange mystery most intriguing. But I must take care. It is of the greatest importance that I do not play the part of what you call the spoil sport.
You mean that Sir Charles must have the star part?
But naturally. He is used to it. And moreover, it is expected of him by somebody else. Is it not? It does not please, mademoiselle, that I begin to concern myself in this matter.
You are what we call quick on the uptake, Monsieur Poirot.
Oh, but it leaps to the eye. And speaking of mademoiselle, tell me, if the question does not appear too frivolous, why is she, with such a beautiful name as Hermione, always called Egg?
I asked Lady Mary that. She told me when the girl was a tiny child, she was, as she put it, a regular roly-poly, always trying to stand up and always rolling over like an egg. And the nickname somehow stuck.
where we must work together, my friend, to the greater glory of her hero, Sir Charles Cartwright. And when the case is solved...
If it is solved.
When? I do not permit myself to fail.
You have never failed?
Since you ask, eh bien, once, long ago, in Belgium. We will not talk about it.
Of course. You were saying that when this case is solved...
Sir Charles will have solved it. I shall merely have been a little cog in the wheel. I desire no honour, no renown. I have all the renown I need. Now tell me, who figures on this list of names Sir Charles mentioned?
I drew it up myself. Here.
Mrs. Dacres, Captain Dacres, Miss Wills, Miss Sutcliffe, Lady Mary Littengore, Hermione Littengore, Oliver Manders. Suggestive, is it not?
What is suggestive about it?
The order in which the names occur.
I simply wrote them down as they came to me.
Exactly. And the list is headed by Mrs. Dacres. I deduce from that she is considered the most likely person to have committed the crime.
The least unlikely would express it better.
I think perhaps she is the person you would all prefer to have committed the crime.
Unconsciously, that may be true.
And the last name on your list, Oliver Manders. He intrigues you, does he not? You may hope that Cynthia Dacres committed the crime, but you think that Oliver Manders did. That is why you kept him till the last. And I, too, am interested in that young man. I was watching him carefully on the night of Stephen Babington's death, and I saw...
What did you see?
I saw that there were two people, at least, who were playing a part. One was Sir Charles. Well, that is quite natural. A great actor does not cease to act because he is not on the stage.
And the other?
Manders was playing the part of a bored and blasé young man, but in reality he was keenly alive and not a little excited. And I think that you noticed him too, and you put him at the bottom of the list because you wanted to keep him for yourself.
Dear me, am I really that sort of man?
Oh, yes. And when you come to talk to Mr. Manders, there is one question I would like you to ask him.
What is that?
Ask him why he faked that motorcycle accident outside Melfort Abbey. Tell him the police are suspicious.
But they didn't seem in the least interested.
It does not matter. You see, Mr. Satterthwaite, I am beginning to understand the mind of the murderer. He is cunning. He reveals to us only what he wishes us to see. If we could find out the reason for Manders' unexpected arrival at the Abbey on the night of Sir Bartholomew's death, it might help us to lift part of the curtain that is concealing what lies behind our intriguing little tragedy. We had returned to Crow's Nest, Sir Charles Cartwright's house in Devon, to pursue the investigation more closely. But I was content to remain in the background and leave it to him to play one of his favourite roles, that of the master detective.
Let's take another look at that list, Satterthwaite.
Oh, yes. Here you are.
Oh, thanks. Now, Lady Mary and Egg don't count, of course. There's no question of them being involved. So, that leaves us with Cynthia and Captain Dacres, Miss Wills, Angie Sutcliffe, and Oliver Manders. Why don't we divide them up,
It would certainly seem to be the most effective way to deal with the problem.
Let's start with Cynthia Dacres.
Well, don't look at me. The world of fashion is definitely not my cup of tea.
Well, Egg seems rather keen to take her on. She has an idea that anyone so perfectly turned out won't get impartial treatment from mere males.
What we need to establish, of course, is whether there is any possible link between the people on this list and poor old Babington.
Yes. It's occurred to me that we ought to find out if any of them spent any time in Gilling. That's where the old boy was vicar before he came to Lumeth.
Well, hardly sounds the kind of place for Captain Dacres. Too far from Newmarket.
I rather thought I might tackle him myself. I know some of his racing cronies, and I dare say I could pick up something that way.
And which of you is to talk to Miss Sutcliffe?
Well, Sir Charles knows her pretty well.
That's precisely why I'd rather someone else took her on. For one thing, I should be accused of not putting my back into the job.
And because she is an old friend, you feel the natural delicacy.
Yeah.
It is perfectly understandable. Why not leave her to the good Mr. Satterthwaite?
Right. Now, what about Oliver Manders? I know he only turned up on the night of Tolly's death as the result of some sort of accident, but we ought to take a look at him, and he certainly knew Babington.
Mr. Satterthwaite will look after Mr. Manders also. But you have missed out a name.
Huh?
Miss Muriel Wills, who writes plays under the name of, what does she call herself?
Anthony Astor.
Well, if Satterthwaite's going to deal with Angie and Manders, I better take a look at her. So, if we're all agreed, I'll go and tell Egg what we've decided. And then we'd better set off back to London.
Miss Lytton Gore, I personally found it impossible to refer to such an attractive and lively young lady as Egg, had decided that the best way to approach Mrs. Dacres would be to pretend that she had come into an unexpected inheritance.
You see, I've never been able to afford any really good clothes before, and I remembered how simply marvellous you looked at that dinner party at Crow's Nest, and I thought, that's the person to advise me on what to wear.
My dear, how utterly charming of you. I simply adore dressing a young girl. And you've got so much personality. You mustn't have anything at all ordinary. Your clothes must be simple and penetrating and just faintly visible, if you understand me. Do you want several things?
I thought about four evening frocks and a couple of day things and a sport suit or two.
Let's start with the evening gowns. Marcel, could we have Amour en Rose?
I suppose you haven't been to Crow's Nest since then?
Oh, my dear, I simply couldn't. It was so upsetting. And anyway, I always think Cornwall too terribly arty. I simply cannot abide artists. Their bodies are always such an odd shape.
It was rather a shattering business, wasn't it? And poor Mr. Babington was such a pet.
Quite a period piece in his way.
You'd met him somewhere before, hadn't you?
That dear old dugout.
Oh, I thought I remembered him saying so. At a place called Gilling?
Marcel, could we have Petit Scandale now? And after that, the Blue Patou.
Wasn't it extraordinary, Sir Bartholomew keeling over like that?
My dear, it was too penetrating for words. It's done me a world of good. All sorts of dreadful women come and order frocks from me, on the off chance I might have murdered him. I rather played up to that. Now, just take a look at this positively provocative frill. Doesn't it make the whole thing quite adorable?
Fortunately, at that moment, a wealthy and quite monumental American lady arrived, and Mrs. Dacres rushed off to welcome her. Miss Lytton Gore made an unobtrusive exit and paced quietly about Bruton Street, waiting until 1 o'clock, when she put the second part of her plan into operation.
Excuse me, but may I speak to you a minute?
Yes, madam, of course.
You're one of the mannequins at Ambrosine's, aren't you? I noticed you this morning. I hope you won't be frightfully offended, but I'm writing an article about working in the fashion business. And I wonder whether you'd like to have lunch with me at the Barclay or somewhere and tell me all about it.
Oh, yes, of course, madam. Oh, but I mustn't be too long. We're only allowed an hour for lunch.
Well, I think that just about covers everything I wanted to ask you. You really have been very helpful. I must admit, I'm rather new to this kind of work. I'm frightfully badly off at the moment. I'm counting on these journalism jobs to keep the wolf from the door.
But from the way you were behaving in the showroom, I thought you...
Oh, no! That was just play acting. I haven't got a bean. I expect Mrs. Dacres would be simply furious if she knew.
Oh, I should say she would.
I got the impression she could be a bit of a tartar.
Well, none of us like her in that effect. She's clever, but she's hard as nails.
I suppose she makes lots of money.
Well, it's not for me to tell tales.
Oh, of course not.
But if you ask me, the firm's not far off Queer Street. It's my belief that Mrs. Dacres has been borrowing heavily just to keep going, in the hopes that the business will brighten up, and that she's got in really deep. Honestly, she looks terrible sometimes, though she's still got an eye for the young men.
Really?
There's been a lot of talk amongst the girls of a fella, very rich, but a bit soft, if you know what I mean. Apparently, Madam has been running him for all he was worth. He might have been able to put things right, but his specialist, or whatever he was, ordered him on a sea voyage. Said he couldn't answer for the consequences if he didn't. They said the specialist was that same chap that got murdered in Yorkshire. Madam was there when it happened, and the girls were having such a laugh saying she'd done him in because he sent her young man away. Of course, it was just fun.
Oh, naturally. I quite understand. But Mrs. Dacres really is my idea of a murderess. So hard and remorseless.
Oh, and she's got such a wicked temper. When she lets go, there's not one of us dares go near her. And they say her husband's scared stiff of her, no wonder.
Tell me, have you ever heard her speak of anyone called Babington? Or a place in Kent, Gilling?
No, I don't remember anything like that. But just look at the time, I must be off.
Oh,
yeah, thanks for the lunch. Oh, and I shall look out for your article.
Although it had been agreed that Sir Charles should talk to Mrs. Dacre's husband, Miss Littengar's curiosity was by now thoroughly aroused, and she went off to the Dacres' flat in St. John's Wood, where she had the good fortune to encounter the gallant captain getting out of a taxi.
Oh, Miss Littengar! What an unexpected pleasure.
Oh.
I just got back from Newbury. Cynthia won't be home for ages. We go round to the 72 Club and have a life now.
How easy the investigation is when one is young and pretty. One does not even have to give an explanation of why one is there.
Something rather amusing about a doctor being poisoned, isn't there? Wrong way about. A doctor's a chap who poisons other people.
It's odd, isn't it, that whenever we meet, it's at a death.
It's damn disturbing. Makes you feel a bit grooey. Fellas popping off all over the place. Makes you wonder if it mightn't be your turn next.
You knew Mr. Babington before, didn't you? At Gilling?
Never heard of the place. Never clapped eyes on the Padre before. Funny thing, him popping off just the same way that Strange did.
Perhaps he was murdered too.
No, no. Nobody murders parsons. Doctors are different.
Yes, I suppose they are.
Yes, interfering devils. Get a fellow shut up. Put him in hell. Shut him up and keep the stuff from him.
You mean that Sir Bartholomew Strange...
Ah, Sir Bartholomew Humbug. I'd like to know what goes on in that sanatorium of his. They put you in there. You can't get out. And they say you've gone in there of your own free will just because they've grabbed you when you've got the horror of that. I'm all to pieces. Jules?
Yes, Colonel?
Will you have another one, my dear?
Not for me.
Well, yeah, another pink gin, Jules. You'd better make it a double.
Yes, Colonel.
Yeah. Lost my nerve for a moment there. Just as well Cynthia wasn't here. I don't want to give the impression I was the one bumped Strange off. But someone... must have done it, though. And it must have been one of us at that party. Which of us? That's the question.
Perhaps you know which.
Well, why should I know? I'll tell you one thing. I wasn't going to take that damned cure of his, no matter how Cynthia went on at me. They were both up to something. But they couldn't fool me.
Tell me, do you know anything about a Mrs. de Rushbridger... who's a patient at the sanatorium?
Rushbridger. Well, I have an idea that Strange said something about her, but... what was it? Trouble is the old memory. It's beginning to go. I can't get a grip on things. I've got enemies, you know. All over the place.
enemies.
Oh, spying on me. All the time. There's probably someone in here now. And what was that woman? What was that woman doing in my room at Strange's place?
What woman?
That rabbit-faced woman who writes plays.
Muriel Wills.
Yeah. You are, Colonel?
Huh? Oh, yeah, thank you. Yeah. Oh, that's better. Yeah. Yes, it was the morning after Strange died. I'd just come up from breakfast. I saw her come out of my room and go through the baize door at the end of the landing. Oh, why did she want to go messing about in my room? Or do you think it's true what Cynthia says?
What does she say?
Well, that I was seeing things. Mind you, I won't deny that I do see things now and again when I get the old, you know. But I mean, seeing a woman is different. And I did see her. It's nasty. Sort of eyes she's got. Go through you.
I must be going. Thank you so much for the drink, Captain Dacus.
No, no, don't thank me, my dear. I'm delighted. Absolutely delighted.
And while Miss Lytton Gower was stealing out through the smoke-laden 72 Club, the good Mr. Satterthwaite was taking tea with Angela Sutcliffe.
Tell me, Mr. Satterthwaite, am I to regard you as a friend or as a sleuth? Have you come here for the sake of my beautiful eyes, as the French say so charmingly? Or are you here just to pump me about the murder?
Can you doubt that the first alternative is the right one?
I can and do. The only thing I can't make up my mind about is whether it is an insult or a compliment to be considered a potential murderess. On the whole, I think it's a compliment. Tell me one thing. Is there anything in what that girl said?
What girl? And what did she say?
Oh, don't be so tiresome. The Lytton Gore girl, the one who's so infatuated with Charles. She thinks that nice old clergyman was murdered, too.
What do you think?
Well, it certainly happened in just the same way. And she's an intelligent girl. Is Charles serious?
I expect your views on that subject are likely to be more valuable than mine.
How appallingly discreet you are. I know Charles pretty well. He seems to me to display all the signs of wanting to settle down. How dull men are when they start to do that.
I've often wondered why Sir Charles has never married.
My dear, he never showed any signs of wanting to. He and I were... Well, it was very pleasant while it lasted, and we're still the best of friends. I suppose that's why the Lytton Gore child gives me such ferocious looks. I'm not at all sure I'm not just a little jealous of her. Why didn't Charles come and catechise me himself? Too much nice feeling, I suppose. Or does he think me guilty? Do you think I'm a murderess, Mr. Satterthwaite?
There would seem to me to be a certain lack of motive.
Well, I also happen to like Bartholomew Strange. And because we were friends, I'd rather like to help track down who killed him.
I suppose you didn't see or hear anything that might have a bearing on the case?
Nothing. I haven't already told the police. And that didn't amount to much.
What about the butler?
I hardly noticed him.
Any peculiar behaviour on the part of any of the guests?
No. Oh, apart from that boy. What was his name?
Oliver Manders.
He turned up very unexpectedly and seemed terribly nervous.
Did Sir Bartholomew seem surprised?
He said he thought it was a very odd business. A new method of gate-crashing, he called it. Only he said, it's my wall he has crashed, not my gate.
I gather he told you something about a secret passage.
Yes. He promised to show it to me. But he never had the chance.
He didn't happen to mention a patient of his, a Mrs. de Rushbridger?
No, never heard of her.
Do you know a place called Gilling in Kent?
I don't think so. Why?
I understood you knew Mr. Babington when he was there.
Who's he?
The old clergyman who died at Crow's Nest.
Oh, that was his name. Who told you I knew him?
Someone who ought to know.
Did they think I had an affair with him or something? Well, clergymen do get up to some very naughty things, like that man in the barrel, but there's nothing doing with your Mr. Babington. I'd never seen him before in my life.
Sir Charles had taken it upon himself to interview Muriel Wills, or Anthony Astor, as the admirers of her moderately entertaining place called her. She lived, somewhat incongruously, with her budgerigars in Tooting, in a house cluttered with porcelain dogs, occasional tables, and Chinese brasses, from Birmingham.
Fancy you tracking me down here, Sir Charles. My mother will be so excited. She just adores the theatre, especially anything romantic. She loved that play where you were a prince at a university.
Ah.
She goes to matinees, you know, and eats chocolates.
Well, I'm very flattered. It is so encouraging to be remembered.
Miss Sutcliffe was here only the other day, and Mother's talked of nothing else since.
Angela was here?
Yes, she's putting on a play of mine. Little Dog Laughed.
Oh, of course. I was reading about it in the Stage. Rather an intriguing title.
I'm so glad you think so. It's a lot of froth and nonsense. It all revolves round Miss Sutcliffe, of course. Everyone dances to her fiddling. That's the idea.
Fascinating. I wonder if you can guess what has brought me here.
Well, I don't suppose it was just to see little me.
It was really Satterthwaite who put the idea into my head.
Oh.
He fancies himself as being a good judge of character.
He's very clever about people.
Mm.
Seems to be rather his hobby.
And he's strongly of the opinion that if there were anything worth noticing on the night of Sir Bartholomew's death, you would have noticed it.
Is that what he said?
Yes.
I was very interested, I must admit. You see, I've never seen a murder at close hand before, so I tried to notice everything I could.
And what exactly did you notice?
Oh, nothing that you'd call interesting, Sir Charles, just little odds and ends. Though there was one thing, something I ought to have told the police about, but I forgot.
What was that?
The butler. He had a kind of strawberry mark on his left wrist. I noticed it when he was handing me vegetables.
Where exactly was the mark? What size was it?
If you'll just stretch out your own wrist. Thank you. It was just here, about the size of a sixpence, and rather the shape of Australia.
A very precise observation.
You think I ought to write to the police and tell them?
Certainly. It might be of the greatest value in tracing the man. Positive marks of identification are not always that easy to come by. And some people are so indeterminate that there's nothing about them to take hold of. Old Babington, for instance. He had a curiously undefined personality.
His hands were very characteristic.
Huh?
What I would call scholar's hands. A little crippled with arthritis, but very refined fingers and beautiful nails.
What an observer you are. But, of course, you knew him before.
No, not me. That was the first time I met him.
But I'm sure he said he'd known you at Gilling.
No. You must have been mixing me up with somebody else, or he was.
Ah. Did it ever occur to you he might have been murdered too?
I know that you and Miss Lytton Gore think so.
And what do you think?
It doesn't seem likely.
So, there's nothing else you can tell me about any of the guests?
No.
Nothing about Mrs. Dacres or Captain Dacres or Oliver Manders?
Nothing.
Well, poor Satterthwaite will be most disappointed.
I am so sorry.
Well, don't forget to tell the police about that thing, Bob.
The mark on the butler's right wrist.
Yeah.
No, I won't forget.
Well, goodbye then.
Goodbye.
Oh, just a minute. Did you say right wrist? You said left just now.
Did I?
Hmm.
Oh, silly of me. Would you mind handing me that brass plate as though it was a vegetable dish? Left side.
Oh. Cabbage, madame?
Thank you, Sir Charles. I'm quite sure now. It was the left wrist, as I said the first time. Stupid of me.
Well, left and right can be terribly puzzling sometimes.
Yes. Memory works in a curious way. Sometimes you see things you never saw in the first place.
The following day, Mr. Satterthwaite took a taxi into the city and made his way to the offices of Spear and Ross, where he found Oliver Manders, who seemed curiously ill at ease.
Did you see the news in the papers this morning?
What news?
Of the post-mortem on Babington.
I heard they were digging the old boy up. What was the verdict?
Poisoned. By nicotine.
Well, at least Egg will be satisfied. She always insisted it was murder.
You don't seem surprised.
Well, frankly, I'm not that much interested. A very dreary business, murder.
You may not be interested, my boy, but I understand the police are beginning to take quite an interest in you.
What exactly do you mean by that?
That rather inartistic accident you contrived outside Melford Abbey. They don't think much of it.
Don't they?
But perhaps you have a perfectly satisfactory explanation.
I've got an explanation. How satisfactory it is, I don't know.
Will you let me be the judge of that?
The whole thing was Sir Bartholomew's idea.
What?
I got a letter from him suggesting that I should fake an accident outside the house and claim his hospitality.
How perfectly extraordinary.
He said he couldn't put his reasons in writing, but he would explain them at the first opportunity.
And did he?
No, he didn't. I got there shortly before dinner. I didn't have the chance to see him alone, and by the end of dinner, he was dead.
You have his letter?
It seems to have disappeared. I can't find it anywhere.
Well, hardly very helpful. Did you say anything to the police?
No. It all seemed too fantastical.
And yet you obeyed Sir Bartholomew's summons?
Yes, I was curious. It all seemed refreshingly out of the way.
Is there anything else?
What do you mean, anything else?
I mean, is there anything that might tell against you?
I suppose you'll hear about it sooner or later. That damned woman isn't likely to hold her tongue.
What damned woman?
That playwright woman. It was the morning after the murder. She asked for my card, and as I took one out of my pocketbook, something fell to the floor. She picked it up and handed it to me.
What was it?
A cutting from a medical journal about nicotine poisoning. I'd never seen it before in my life.
How very awkward.
I suppose she told the police?
Not as far as I know. I fancy she's a woman who likes to keep things to herself. Quite a dangerous woman in her way.
She knows something. I'll swear she knows something.
What do you think of Oliver's story, Monsieur Poirot?
It strikes me as most peculiar and highly uncharacteristic of the late Sir Bartholomew.
You mean he's lying?
There are so many kinds of lies.
But it does chime in with what Lady Mary said about Tolly cooking up some kind of surprise.
Oh, I think he was probably pulling Mummy's leg. Still, we're not getting anywhere. Failure all along the line. What do we do now, Monsieur Poirot?
We think.
What's the good of that?
With the exercise of the little grey cells...
Oh, I'm sick of hearing you going on about your little grey cells. Can't you do anything?
Very well, mademoiselle. It shall be as you wish. I will give a party. The sherry party. That is fashionable, is it not?
A sherry party?
And to it I will ask Mrs. Cynthia Dacres and Captain Dacres, Miss Sutcliffe, Miss Wills, Mr. Manders, and your charming mother, mademoiselle. And to do it in style, I will reserve an apartment at the Ritz.
Wonderful! And something will happen at the party, won't it? Just like in detective stories. All the people will be there, and you will announce who did it.
Quite the spider's parlour, Monsieur Poirot. And all your poor little flies have walked in.
All gathered together again, eh? Third time lucky, perhaps.
Oh, no, Captain. This is a friendly little party. Do not let us talk of murder. These things, they spoil the palate. Let us eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die.
Not as soon as all that, I hope.
Oh, malheur, I have mentioned death. Forgive me, Mrs. Dacres. And allow me to congratulate you on a very charming gown. Your health, madame.
Your health, Lady Mary.
Here's to you, Egg.
Cheerio.
Cheers.
Ah, it is an excellent drink, the sherry. I prefer it to the cocktail, and 1,000 times to the whisky. By drinking the whisky, you ruin the palate. To appreciate the delicate wines of France...
Charles! What's the matter?
Oh, God! Not another one.
Has Sir Charles been poisoned too? It's quite unbelievable!
The poor devil's dead!
My friends, do not...
You fool! Pretending to be God and know all about everything! And you let this happen!
Another murder, Monsieur Poirot, and under your very nose. If you'd let the whole thing alone, this would never have happened. It's you who's murdered Charles. You! Another murder! And under your very nose, Monsieur Poirot. If you'd let the whole thing alone, this wouldn't have happened. It's you who murdered Charles.
It is true, mademoiselle, I confess. I murdered Sir Charles. But I am a very special kind of murderer. I can kill, and I can restore the dead to life. A magnificent performance, Sir Charles. Perhaps you would now like to take your curtain call.
You beast!
Madame, monsieur, I demand pardon of you all. This little farce was necessary to prove to you all, and incidentally to prove to myself, a fact which my reason already told me was true. In one of the glasses on this tray, I placed a teaspoonful of water. That water represented pure nicotine. These glasses are of the same kind as those used by Sir Bartholomew Strange. Owing to the heavily cut glass, a small quantity of colourless liquid is quite undetectable. Imagine then the port glass of Sir Bartholomew. After it was put out on the dining table, somebody introduced into it a sufficient quantity of pure nicotine. That could have been done by anyone, the butler, the parlour maid, or one of the guests who might have slipped into the dining room on their way downstairs. Dessert arrives, and the port glass is filled. Sir Bartholomew drinks and dies.
So simple when you come to think of it.
Now, suppose that tonight was not a farce, but a tragedy. Sir Charles is dead. What will be the first step taken by the police?
Why, to find the glass, of course. It's here, where Charles let it fall.
And you are of the opinion that if the glass had contained nicotine, traces of it would be found by the police?
Yes, I suppose so.
You would have supposed wrong. No nicotine would have been found, for that is not the glass from which Sir Charles drank. The real glass I have been hiding behind the tail of my coat. Voila.
What?
Tis like the conjuring trick. The attention cannot be in two places at once. The conjurer waits for the psychological moment.
When Charles did his spectacular collapse.
Everyone crowds round the body, and no one at all, looks at Hercule Poirot. And it is then that I make the exchange of the glasses.
And that's what happened at Crow's Nest and at Melford Abbey.
And why nobody found any trace of nicotine in the cocktail glass or the port glass.
So who changed them?
That still has to be revealed.
You don't know?
Perhaps. Perhaps not.
Well, I think that's quite enough excitement for one evening, Monsieur Poirot. It's time I was off.
Yes, I agree.
One little moment, I beg you. Tonight we have played the comedy, but that comedy may so easily have become a tragedy. Under certain conditions, the murderer may strike a third time. Now, if any one of you knows anything that may bear in any way on these crimes, I implore that person to speak out now. To keep any knowledge to oneself may be dangerous. No one? Be it so, then. I have given you warning. I can do no more.
That was a damn clever bit of work, Poirot.
But was that the only reason why you planned it? To see if you could switch the glasses?
No, mademoiselle, I had one other aim.
What was that?
I wanted to watch the expression on one person's face when Sir Charles fell dead.
Which person?
That is my secret.
Well, won't you tell us what you saw?
No, this is not the time, mademoiselle.
Does that mean you know who the murderer is?
You may put it that way if you wish.
A telegram for Monsieur Poirot.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
But what does it say?
See for yourselves.
Please come and see me at once. K. can give you valuable information about Sir Bartholomew Strange's death. Margaret de Rushbridger.
So, we were right after all. She has got something to do with the case.
What do you think the mystery is?
I can't imagine. But it's bound to throw some light on the Babington affair. If Tolly got those people together at Melford Abbey, then the surprise he was going to spring on them had something to do with Mrs. de Rushbridger. I think we can assume that, don't you, Monsieur Poirot?
This telegram certainly complicates the affair. But we must act quickly, very quickly.
Well, we could, I suppose, take the first train up tomorrow morning. But is it really necessary for all of us to go?
Sir Charles and I had arranged to drive down to Dilling to talk to Mrs. Milray.
She's the mother of my secretary and was living there when Babington was vicar. Mm-hmm. But we can always postpone that.
But I don't think we ought to postpone anything. Surely Monsieur Poirot and Mr. Satterthwaite could go to Yorkshire.
An excellent arrangement. Sir Charles is obviously the right person to talk to Mrs. Milray, and who knows, you may learn from her far more important facts than we shall discover at Melfort Abbey.
I simply cannot understand how you could have possibly had a telegram from Mrs. de Rushbridger. There must be some madman about. It's been such confusion everywhere, what with the police and everything.
The police?
Yeah, perhaps it would be best, matron, if we were to see Mrs. de Rushbridger straight away.
Then you don't know?
Know what?
Mrs. de Rushbridge is dead.
Dead? Oh, mon Dieu, I should have seen. How did she die?
It was all very strange. A box of chocolates came for her, liqueur chocolates, by post. She ate one. It must have tasted horrible. But she was taken by surprise, I suppose, and she swallowed it. One doesn't like spitting a thing out.
No, I understand. And if a liquid runs suddenly down your throat, it is difficult.
So she swallowed it and called out, and the nurse came running, but we couldn't do anything. She died in about 2 minutes. Then the doctor sent for the police, and they came and examined the chocolates. All the top layer had been tampered with.
And the poison involved?
They think it was nicotine.
Of course. Oh, what an audacious stroke. If it is possible, madame, I would like to see the dead woman's body.
Of course. If you could just wait here a moment.
Her death was not peaceful. The agony of it still shows on her face.
Poor soul. Someone knew she was going to speak and killed her.
Yes, that is so.
She was murdered to prevent her telling us what she knew.
Or what she did not know. But let us return to London. There have been too many deaths. The murderer is much more dangerous than I had thought.
So who sent that telegram? Did you find out?
According to the police, it was handed in at Melfort Post Office by a small boy. He said it had been given to him that morning by a man dressed in shabby clothes who said a strange lady at the house in the park had thrown it down to him from her window, wrapped round 2 half-crowns.
How excessively melodramatic. What do you make of it, Poirot?
It proves what I have always said. There is nothing to be gained by rushing up and down England. What did you find out from your visit to Dilling?
Nothing at all, I'm afraid.
Precisely. The truth can only be seen from within.
What do you want to do, then?
I want to think. I only ask of you 24 hours in which to think.
Will thinking tell you what it was that poor woman could have said if she had lived?
I believe so.
It hardly seems possible. But if you can see through the mystery, it's more than I can. I'm beaten, and I confess it. I've decided to give up playing the great detective. There's just one thing. I'm rather worried about Miss Wills.
What about her?
She's gone.
Gone where?
Well, nobody knows. After I got your telegram about Mrs. de Rushbridger, I started to think things over. I felt convinced that Miss Wills was hiding something, and I thought I'd have a shot at getting it out of her. I drove out to Tooting, but she wasn't there. A people had received a telegram from her saying she'd gone away for a day or two, and not to worry.
And were they worried?
Yes, they were. You see, she hadn't taken any luggage with her.
I warned her. I warned everyone. You remember I said to them, speak now.
Do you think that she, too?
I have my own ideas. For the moment, I prefer not to discuss them.
Then we'll leave you to it.
For 24 hours. I must have the absolute concentration.
What on earth are you doing? building card houses.
It is not that I have become childish in my dotage. It is an old habit of mine and most stimulating to the mind. This morning, first thing, I go out and buy a pack of cards. Unfortunately, I make an error. They are not real cards.
Oh, they've sold you Happy Families.
Hmm? What is that, the Happy Family?
It's a game. Children play it in the nursery.
Ah, they serve just as well.
Master Bun the Baker's son. I always loved him. And here's Mrs. Mug, the milkman's wife. I suppose that's me.
Oh, why is that funny card you, mademoiselle?
Because of the name. Charles and I are going to be married. And his name's not really Cartwright at all. It's Mug. So I'm going to be Lady Mug.
And is that why he no longer wants to play the great detective?
Perhaps it is. But aren't you going to wish me happiness?
Oh, I do wish you happiness, mademoiselle. The happiness that endures. The happiness that is built on a rock.
I'll tell Charles you called him a rock. But what do you hope to find from your Happy Family house?
Ah, it is the question I ask myself without ceasing. Why was Mr. Babington killed? When I can answer that, the case will be solved.
Well, I'll leave you to it. I'm sorry to have disturbed you. Charles and I are going to the dress rehearsal of Little Dog Laughed. It's the first night tomorrow.
Oh, mon Dieu.
What is it? Has something happened?
Yes, indeed, something has happened. But do not be alarmed. You go off to your dress rehearsal. But tomorrow evening, before the first night, I would like you and Sir Charles and Mr. Satterthwaite to come here. By then, perhaps my little idea will have worked itself out. I hope you enjoy the play.
Goodbye then, Monsieur Poirot. I wish I knew what you were up to.
But yes, everything explains itself. A motive such as I have never come across. The Happy Families, I need them no longer.
So, Monsieur Poirot, did your card trick come off?
Have you found our murderer?
Well, come on, man, don't keep us on tenterhooks.
I know, Sir Charles. The tenterhooks are part of my method. You must allow me to reconstruct the crime in my own way.
As you please, Monsieur Poirot.
I will begin with the murder of Stephen Babington last August. On that evening, Sir Charles advanced the theory that the unfortunate clergyman had been murdered. I did not agree.
Because you could not believe that anyone would want to kill a man like Babington.
Or that it was possible to kill one particular person by putting poison in one glass on a tray of cocktails.
But I must admit that Sir Charles was right and I was wrong. I was wrong because I was looking at the crime from an entirely false angle. It was only 24 hours ago that I perceived the proper angle of vision.
When you were building your house of cards?
One should always start an investigation with the simplest and most obvious questions. Granted that Stephen Babington had died as a result of drinking a cocktail, who had the best opportunity of poisoning his glass?
Well, I did, I suppose. And the parlourmaid, of course.
But neither Sir Charles nor the parlourmaid could have directed that particular glass to Babington's hand. It looked as if chance, and chance alone, had led him to pick it up.
And what about the glass that poisoned Sir Bartholomew?
Well, I think we can safely say that we have eliminated the main suspect, the butler, Ellis.
But there is also the possibility that any one of the guests could have slipped into the dining room and put nicotine into the glass.
That's why we drew up the list of the people who'd been at Crow's Nest and at Melford Abbey.
And the first four names on your list, Captain and Mrs. Dacres, Miss Sutcliffe and the observant Miss Wills, I discarded immediately.
Why?
It was impossible that any one of them could have known that they were going to meet Stephen Babington at dinner. The use of nicotine as a poison indicated a carefully thought-out plan, not one that could be put into action on the spur of the moment.
But what about young Manders? He would have known that Babington would be at Crow's Nest, and he was at Melford Abbey as well.
Yes, Oliver Manders was by far the most likely suspect. And since that is still the case, I asked him to join us here. He has been patiently awaiting his cue. Will you come in, Mr. Manders?
Good evening. I rather gather congratulations are in order, Sir Charles.
They are indeed. Thank you, Manders.
Thank you, Oliver.
As I was saying, Mr. Manders drew attention to himself that evening at Crow's Nest. He was tense and on edge,
and he had actually quarrelled with or had displayed marked animosity towards Mr. Babington.
Yes, I felt sorry about that after the old boy died, but I've got rather a short fuse where clergymen are concerned.
And then there were the curious circumstances of his arrival at Melfort Abbey on the night Sir Bartholomew was murdered.
Yes, but I explained all that to Mr. Satterthwaite. It was the old boy himself who suggested I fake the accident.
But you no longer have his letter?
No. I must have lost it somewhere.
None of this is very convincing, Mr. Mandos.
Convincing or not, it's the truth.
Yes, Mr. Mandos, I believe it is. You were the most obvious suspect, but then I began to realize that that was what I was supposed to think. I had been led to believe that the murderer would be someone who had been present both at Crow's Nest and at Melfort Abbey, and everything pointed to you. But a really clever criminal would have realized that anyone who had been at both places would be bound to be under suspicion and therefore would have arranged not to be apparently there.
You mean that there was someone present at Melfort Abbey who had been at Crow's Nest but was not recognized? That could hardly apply to Miss Milroy or to Mrs. Babington. And Sir Charles and I were in the south of France, and even if we had somehow sneaked back into the country, the company at Melfort Abbey would have known us instantly.
You, perhaps, Mr. Satterthwaite, but Sir Charles is a different matter. He is an actor, accustomed to playing many parts, which led me to reconsider that very mysterious person, Ellis the butler. A man who appears from nowhere a fortnight before the crime and vanishes afterwards with complete success. Why was Ellis so successful? Because Ellis did not really exist.
But you're not seriously suggesting that Ellis was Charles? That's ridiculous. The servants would have recognized him.
And what about Tolly? I don't mind you indulging your little fancies, Poirot, but you can't tell me I could have fooled my oldest friend.
Oh, no, he knew perfectly well who you were. It had been arranged between you. Sir Bartholomew gave it away when he said, "You're a first-class butler, aren't you, Ellis?"
I must admit it did seem to be an extraordinary thing to say.
But perfectly understandable if Sir Bartholomew was in on the joke, a joke that was intended to deceive the whole house party. Hence Sir Bartholomew's cheerful humour and his remark to Miss Sutcliffe about the surprise he was going to spring on everyone. And after the murder had been accomplished, Ellis left by the secret passage, resumed his own identity, and 2 days later was strolling through the gardens at Monte Carlo, ready to be shocked and surprised by the news of his old friend's death.
I really cannot believe a word of this. What about the blackmailing letters we discovered in Ellis's room?
They were written by Sir Charles, who then contrived to have you discover them. And just consider the opportunities available to a butler. In valeting the gentlemen, he could fold and press their clothes, and in the process, remove certain letters.
You mean he took the letter that Sir Bartholomew had written to me?
And planted the press cutting, which fell so conveniently at Miss Wills's feet.
I was beginning to wonder whether she might have planted it herself.
Let us now turn to the part played by Miss Wills. She is a curious personality, apparently completely nondescript, but of extraordinary intelligence and perception. She was the only person who occasioned Sir Charles any uneasiness. That is why he was so concerned to tackle her himself. He was fairly reassured by the interview and distinctly gratified that she had noticed the birthmark he had gone to such pains over. But then came the catastrophe. I do not think that until then it had occurred to her that Ellis was Sir Charles, but she had noticed the hands that held the dishes at dinner, and it did suddenly occur to her that Sir Charles was Ellis. And so she asked him to pretend to hand her a dish of vegetables. But it was not whether the birthmark was on the left or the right wrist that interested her. She wanted a pretext to study his hands.
You're making this up. How can you possibly know what happened?
Because I've been talking with her, mademoiselle. That is why I advised her to leave her home immediately, so as not to share the same fate as Mrs. de Rushbridger.
But how does she fit into all this? I don't understand.
Sir Charles was worried.
He did not like the expression of satisfied malice he had seen on Miss Wills's face. Attention must be focused elsewhere. On the day of my sherry party, Sir Charles rose very early, went to Yorkshire, and, disguised in shabby clothes, gave a telegram to a boy to send off, and he did one thing more. He dispatched a box of poisoned chocolates to a woman he had never seen and of whom he knew nothing. It was a splendid coup de théâtre. Mrs. de Rushbridger had something of importance to tell us. Mrs. de Rushbridger was killed before she could speak, but I, Hercule Poirot, was not deceived.
So that was what you meant when you said she had been killed before she could tell us what she did not know.
Mm-hmm.
She had nothing to do with the case at all. She was simply a red herring.
Precisely, mon ami. But in his seeming triumph, Sir Charles made a stupid, childish error. The telegram was addressed to me, Hercule Poirot, at the Ritz Hotel. But Mrs. de Rushbridger knew nothing at all of my connection with the crime.
Childish, as you say.
So, I had reached the stage where I knew the identity of the murderer, and I saw, for the first time, that the death of Sir Bartholomew Strange was his overall objective. But what reason could Sir Charles have to kill off his old friend? Could I work out a motive?
Monsieur Poirot, don't you think this has gone on long enough? Huh? I know that it is part of your performance to focus everyone's attention on the wrong man, so that they will be all the more astounded when the real criminal is revealed.
Yes.
You have had your fun. You have spun out this absurd story. Now, don't you think it's time you told us who the real murderer is?
Alas, I cannot oblige you, Sir Charles. The real murderer has already been revealed.
So what was my motive for taking the life of a man I had known ever since my school days?
Your motive is sitting there, Sir Charles. Miss Hermione Little Girl.
What do you mean by that?
It was clear from the first time I saw you together that Sir Charles loved you. Loved you with that terrible, absorbing passion that comes to a man in middle age and which is usually inspired by an innocent young girl. You loved her, Sir Charles. She, it was evident, had the hero worship for you. You had only to speak for her to fall into your arms, but you did not speak. Why?
You know damned well why. I thought she was in love with Manders.
You did not believe that for a second. You are a man of the world. You knew perfectly well Miss Littlegirl's feelings for you. Why then did you not marry her? It could only have been because there was some obstacle. And the obstacle was the fact that you already had a wife.
That's absurd.
You married when you were very young, before you became known as an actor.
But if that's the case, what happened to her? Where is she now?
There are two tragedies for which the law gives no relief. The woman you married might be serving a life sentence in some prison, or she might be confined to a lunatic asylum. In neither case could you obtain a divorce.
I don't believe any of this.
If nobody knew, you might marry Miss Littlegirl without telling her the truth. But supposing one person was aware of it. A man you had known since boyhood.
Sir Bartholomew Strange.
An honourable, upright physician. Oh, he might pity you deeply. He might sympathise with a liaison with an irregular life. But he would not stand by silent and see you enter into a bigamous marriage with an unsuspecting young girl.
What about Babington? Did he know about it too?
I thought so at first. But I found nothing to support my theory. Then, a chance remark from Miss Lytton Gore about going to a dress rehearsal opened my eyes. The poison in the glass picked up by Mr. Babington was intended for any of those present in the room, with three exceptions. Yourself, Miss Lytton Gore, to whom you were careful to hand an innocent glass, and Sir Bartholomew, who did not drink cocktails.
But that's nonsense. What's the point of it?
A very singular point. The murder of Stephen Babington
was nothing more nor less than a dress rehearsal.
You really have the most extraordinary imagination, Monsieur Poirot. It goes without saying there isn't a syllable of truth in this absurd fandangle. Where's your evidence, eh?
My evidence, Sir Charles, is in the Hiverton County Asylum. Gladys Mary Mugg, the wife of Charles Mugg, your lawful wedded wife.
Is this true? Is this really true, Monsieur Poirot?
It is true, mademoiselle.
God damn you, Poirot. God damn you!
He'll escape.
No, no. He will only choose his exit. Oh, the slow one before the eyes of the world, or the quick one off stage.
Oliver, take me home, please.
Yeah, of course. Well, you're trembling. Will you be all right?
I'll be all right. Stay with me, Oliver.
Be very good to her.
I will. You know that. Good night, Monsieur Poirot. Thank you.
My dear Poirot, you have been wonderful, absolutely wonderful.
It is nothing. A tragedy in three acts. And now the curtain has fallen.
My goodness, I've only just realised. That poison cocktail. Anyone could have drunk it. It might have been me.
There is an even more terrible possibility that you have not considered.
And what is that?
It might have been me.
In Agatha Christie's three-act tragedy, Hercule Poirot was played by John Moffat, Mr. Satterthwaite by George Cole, Sir Charles Cartwright, Michael Cochrane, Sir Bartholomew Strange, Clive Medicine, Egg Lytton Gore, Beth Chalmers, Lady Mary Lytton Gore, Pauline Jameson, Oliver Manders, Carl Prekop, Muriel Wills, Elizabeth Proud, Angela Sutcliffe, Gemma Churchill, Captain Dacres, Nigel Anthony, Cynthia Dacres, Paula Jacobs, the Reverend Stephen Babington, Peter Marinka, Mrs. Babington, Patricia Scott, Colonel Johnson, John Baddeley, Superintendent Crossfield, Martin Hyder, Mrs. Leckie, Kathleen Helm, Miss Milray, Helen Longworth, Doris the Model, Angela Sims, the Matron, Natasha Pine, the little boy, Tom Glenister. Three-act tragedy was dramatized by Michael Bakewell. It was directed by Enid Williams for BBC Radio 4 and is published in the UK by BBC Worldwide.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.